Hare Krishna.
So, good morning, New Dwarka.
Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 4, Text 30. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Tasya Daitya Pate Putras Chatvara Parama Adbhuta Prahrado Abhun Mahans Tesham Gunair Mahat Upasakaha Tasya Daitya Patek Putras Tasya Daitya Patek Putras Chatvara Paramadbhuta Chatvara Paramadbhuta Prahrado Bhun Mahans Tesham Prahrado Bhun Mahans Tesham Gunair Mahadupasakaha Gunair Mahadupasakaha Tasya Daitya Patek Putras Chattarak Paramadbhuta Prahrado Bhun Mahans Tesham Gunair Mahadupasakaha Tasya Daitya Patek Putras Chattaro Paramadbhuta Prahrado Bhun Mahans Tesham Gunair Mahadupasakaha Tasya Daitya Patek Putras Chattara Paramadbhuta Prahrado Bhun Mahans Tesham Gunair Mahadupasaka Tasya Daitya Patek Putras Chattarak Paramadbhuta Prahrado Bhun Mahans Tesham Gunair Mahadupasaka Tasya Daitya Patek Putras Tattara Paramadbhuta Prahrado Bhun Mahans Tesham Gunair Mahadupasaka. So, the ladies. Tasya Daitya Patek Putras Chattara Paramadbhuta Prahrado Bhun Mahans Tesham Gunair Mahadupasakam Tasya Daitya Patek Putras Chattara Paramadbhuta Prahrado Bhun Mahans Tesham Gunair Mahadupasakam. So, Srila Prabhupada's translation and purport for this verse. Tasya means of him, Hiranyakashipu, which is gold cushion. You've heard of Goldfinger? Well, this is James Bond. This is gold cushion. Hiranyakashipu. Daitya Pate, the king of the Daityas. Putraha, sons. Chatwara, four. Paramadbhuta, very qualified and wonderful. Prahlada, the one named Prahlada. Abhut, was Mahan, the greatest. Tesham, of all of them. Gunaik, with transcendental qualities, Mahadupasakaha, being an unalloyed devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Prabhupada's translation. Hiranyakashipu had four wonderful, well-qualified sons, of whom the one named Prahlad was the best. Indeed, Prahlad was a reservoir of all transcendental qualities because he was an unalloyed devotee of the personality of Godhead. Prabhupada's purport, jasyasti bhaktir bhagavatya kinchana sarvair gunaistatra samasate sura. In one who has unflinching devotional faith in Krishna, all the good qualities of Krishna and the demigods are consistently manifest. That's Bhagavatam 5.8.12. Prahlad Maharaj is praised herein for having all good qualities because of worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, a pure devotee who has no motives has all good qualities, material and spiritual. A pure devotee who has no motives, in other words, no mundane motives, has all good qualities, material and spiritual. If one is spiritually advanced, being a staunch, liberal devotee of the Lord. See that? Devotees are Democrats. Just kidding. This is an old sense of the word liberal. If one is spiritually advanced, being a staunch, liberal devotee of the Lord, all good qualities are manifest in his body. On the other hand, harava bhaktasya kuto maharguna. If one is not a devotee, even if he has some materially good qualities, they have no value, spiritual value. That is the verdict of the Vedas. Prabhupada ki jai. Namo om Vishnu padaya Krishna priestaya bhutale srimate bhakti vedant samaniti namine. Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvisesa Shunyavari Pasyate Desha Tarine. Tasya Daitya Patek Putras Chattara Paramadhuta Prahrado Bhun Mahangs Te Shang Gunayar Maharupasaka. So, let's take a look at this. Daitya, of course, refers to the demons, our good buddies, the demons, who are sons of Diti. Interestingly, and this is, of course, Krishna's arrangement. Krishna is the great author of the universe and sort of choreographs all these cosmic events. And by Krishna's arrangement, on the higher celestial plane, just as on this earth there are the good guys and the bad guys and mostly just the middle guys, so similarly, on the higher planes of the universe, celestial planes, there are suras, godly people, and asuras, the ungodly. And they are family, right? They're father, the father of these, the asuras, the great gods, and then you have the daityas, the children of Diti, and the danavas, the children of Danu. And but in both cases, their father is Kashyapas, their half-brothers. Which is interesting because one remarkable feature of the Absolute Truth is that unlike other attempts to conceptualize the universe or what's going on here in the universe, there is no absolute evil. There's no absolute evil. There are other... How should I put it? On the road back to Krishna, there are different levels of clarity. And at one level, people conceive of the universe as being sort of fundamentally divided into good and evil. This is typical of Gnostic philosophies, GN, Gnostic from Jnana. So, you can talk about different, even indigenous American philosophies like the Mayans or Aztecs, but you find this throughout the world, the idea that the universe is fundamentally divided into good and evil, and some people are just good, they're just always good, and some people are just always bad, and the good and bad people really have nothing to do with each other, except sometimes they fight, and hopefully the good guys win. And so you get this notion of cosmic battles, universal battles, and what's interesting about the way the universe really is, as we learn in Bhagavatam, is that, of course, there is this struggle. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita begins with the words dharma kshetra, on the field of morality, or on the field of justice, on the field of dharma. So the very first words of the Gita is that, and field is used in Sanskrit just as in English to mean not only, let's say, a piece of land, but a field also is an area of activity. For example, in the Gita, Krishna famously calls the body kshetra. Idang shariram kaunteya, this body kaunteya. Kshetra abhidhiyate, kshetra miti abhidhiyate, is designated as the field. So the Bhagavad Gita not only takes place, the battle of Kurukshetra, on a physical field, which it did, on a flat piece of land where the battle took place, but also it is a field in the sense, an area of human struggle and activity in which ultimately there is good versus evil. So the very first words of the Gita, Dharma Kshetra, on the field of justice, or in the field of justice, of morality. And yet ultimately, this good and evil are not irreconcilably divided. There is an ultimate unity of everything. And that ultimate unity is in God, so that there really aren't absolutely bad people. But on the other hand, there are absolutely good people, and everyone is ultimately good. So by Krishna's arrangement, Krishna could have created the universe so the suras and asuras were not even like, 42nd cousins or anything. He could have arranged this, but he didn't. He made them half-brothers. So it's, again, one and different. This one and different is everywhere. So they're brothers, but they're half-brothers. And ultimately, as we know, at the end of this story of Prahlad, Hiranyakashipu will get liberation. It's not that he'll go to hell forever and be tortured in the most imaginative possible ways. But ultimately, even Hiranyakashipu, gold cushion, he will actually be liberated because he's also part of Krishna. So in the Bhagavatam, you don't ultimately hate anyone. Krishna says throughout the Gita that one should be free of raga dvesha, which means kind of like getting excitedly passionate. I know that nowadays in America, passion has become a positive word, like, what's your passion? My passion is skateboarding. Or my passion, it's not really. But whatever. But apart from that current positive sense of the word passion, which means you're very enthusiastic about something, you really love to do it, the word passion in our philosophy technically means enthusiasm for something which is tainted by vanity, selfish ambition, pride, and just a desire to be better than other people. Like, I want to make a lot of money so that I can stand above the crowd. Or I want to be honored more than other people. So this tainted happiness, this sort of somewhat toxic enthusiasm, is what we mean by passion. And then the opposite of that, of course, is we hate something. And so when you don't really, when we become free from selfish passion, we also become free from hatred. Because it's like, let's say that the easiest example is two people who become attached to each other, romantic couple, and then, reality sets in and there's some kind of difficulty. And you get pop songs like, you cheated, you lied, you said that you love me. That's the Shields, by the way, from the... I don't know the exact date, but... So when there's a breakup in a romantic relationship, we suffer exactly as much as we try to enjoy. So you can actually, measure your suffering, and then you know exactly how much you tried to exploit the material world, or you tried to exploit another person. It's exactly symmetrical. So in any case, because the spiritual platform is Shuddha Sattva, it is purified goodness. Therefore, on the spiritual platform, there is no selfish passion, and therefore there is no hatred. So a worldview, a cosmology, a so-called metaphysical system, which includes like despising bad people or seeing some people as absolutely evil, is still infected by passion. Because on the platform of absolute goodness, there's charity for all, as Abraham Lincoln said. And ultimately, everyone is part of Krishna. So this is the ultimate resolution of everything. Therefore, Prabhupada actually talks about this in the beginning of his introduction to the Bhagavatam, where he says there's a vast difference between a mere conception of God and that of absolute truth. You can see someone as the supreme being, the highest being, but not an absolute truth that encompasses and includes everything. As Arjun says in the Gita, and he says to Krishna, sarvam samapnosi tatosi sarvam. You encompass everything. You include everything. Therefore, you are everything.
So anyway, that's a word in the Daitya. So here, tasya daitya pate putras, chatvara kuramadhuta, the daitya pati, the lord of the daityas, Hiranyakashipu, had four sons, chatvara putras, who were parama adhuta, like most amazing. Adhuta means amazing or wonderful. It can be, you know, wonderful in some strange way also, but just parama adhuta, they were most amazing. And Prahlado Bhun Mahan Tesham, Tesham, among them, Prahlad was great. Among them, Prahlad was the great one. Even though they were very amazing, but among them, Prahlad was actually great. So Prahlado Bhun Mahan Tesham, Gunai, he was great by qualities. So a word on this word, actually several words on this word. Guna in Sanskrit means quality, and just like in English, the word quality can mean any quality, like this person has the quality of being too angry or something, or I don't like the quality of this tangerine. But you can also use the word quality positively to mean something which has good quality, like this is a quality product. And it's exactly like that in Sanskrit, that you can use the word guna to mean any quality, as the qualities of passion, goodness, or ignorance. But also it can be used to mean specifically a good quality. And in that sense, it's used as the opposite of dosha, guna dosha, good quality and bad quality. So here, now in this particular case, Prahlad's good qualities specifically refer to qualities of character. In other words, in this context, if someone was rich, that wouldn't be a guna. That would simply be wealth. But here, it specifically means that he had quality of character. And Prabhupada quotes the verse, yasyasti bhaktir bhagavati akinchana. One who has akinchana bhakti, which literally means like nothing else bhakti. Kinchana in Sanskrit means something, and akinchana means nothing. So that means devotion to Krishna, in which I don't have any other motive. Whatever I do for Krishna, my actual intention is to please Krishna. Because as we know, we are enjoined to practice devotional service within communities. And all of us experience that it is in association with communities, or within a community, that we can practice Krishna consciousness well. And yet communities, ultimately, the way they're set up, this is sociology 1A, they have, rewards and punishments. Every community has certain values, and if you fulfill the values or promote the values of that community, you're rewarded with honor, or maybe you get a little trophy or a wall certificate or praise, or people love you. And if you do the opposite, you get the opposite. And so, of course, Rupa Goswami talks about this, all the our books talk about this. You can sort of lock in to the punishment reward system and sort of engage in a Krishna conscious community. We can do that to fulfill our human desires. So, and we see that sometimes, like someone was really like a sadhana champion, and then one day, where'd so-and-so go? And that's why Rupa Goswami says in his Upadeshamrita, Niyamagraha, that famous bivalent, that word that goes both ways, that niyama means a rule, like it's the second stage of Ashtanga Yoga, Yama Niyama. So niyama literally means restraint or something which regulates your behavior, governs your behavior. And then graha, which we still have in English, actually. We have an English word from graha, grasp or grab. So niyama can mean intensely, agraha, like really grasping onto, or it can be, according to the Sunday rules, not, like atheist, not. Agraha, not taking it, not grasping it. So interestingly, devotional service cannot be reduced down to external behavior. The external behavior is necessary, but not sufficient. Let's say, for example, I rise early and the community sees me chanting. So, according to Rupa Goswami, that's something we should do. That's necessary. But
who knows what my motive is? Maybe I just don't want to get in trouble, or I don't want to lose my free rent, or I just want people to love and admire me and appreciate me, or whatever. Or maybe I'm doing it because I love Krishna, or because I'm trying to love Krishna. So it's actually Krishna in the heart, the antaryami, Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita describes himself as Sakshi, the witness. And so Krishna knows what my motive is. And that's why the process of devotional service cannot be reduced down to external behavior. Because the external behavior is meant to awaken an inner state of consciousness. And whether or not I am really opening my heart, what are we supposed to say nowadays, the heart chakra? I said it in a Bhagavatam class, the heart chakra. Anyway, whether or not, whether I'm simply performing the external activity or I'm actually internally there, Krishna knows that. Krishna knows that. Others may not know it. I may fake out a community if I'm kind of, but you can't fake out Krishna. On the other hand, someone may be struggling and may not be, let's say, externally the greatest thing since sliced bread prasadam. But within that person's heart, there may be real sincerity. That person may really be trying, may really want to do the right thing for Krishna. And Krishna knows that too. Krishna knows that too. And so devotional service cannot be reduced down to a mechanism. That's the Mimamsa approach. The whole idea of Mimamsa is that you can mechanize success in life. After all, as we know, as Prabhupada always taught, we're in the material world because we want to lord it over nature. But if someone's not simply in the mode of ignorance and just acting entirely irrationally, then you learn very early on in this world that the way you lord it over efficiently is you've got to figure something out, how it works, master it, and then make the system work for you. Whether it's technology, whether it's success in college, whether it's success in a relationship. And so, therefore, because we bring this mode of efficiency to the process of Krishna consciousness, after all, that's the way we live in this world, there can be a tendency to, like, okay, I can figure this out, I can get it down, I nailed it, I understand bhakti yoga, and you probably don't need Krishna. I mean, that is the Mimamsa philosophy. I mean, I don't mean you don't really need Krishna, I mean, in this worldview. I should put an iti after this so it's understood this is the thought of the clueless. I mean, for example, in Mimamsa philosophy, they're the super categorizers. They categorize everything, and because they study rituals and reduce rituals down to this science. And so in the Mimamsa system, the gods or deities or whatever god is formally placed in the same category as things like leaf cups and spoons and ghee. In other words, it's just paraphernalia. The gods have no discretionary power. It's like, if you go to get a driver's license and you're old enough and you pass the test and whatever, the person at the counter has to give you a license. It's not like, let's say, in some third world countries where it takes a little something more to get their driver's license. So in this Mimamsa system, the gods are simply bureaucrats. They're just bureaucrats. It's really about mastering the mechanism. And we can bring this approach to Krishna consciousness, where you just master sadhana bhakti. And if you do that, then you will advance. And it's not like that. But again, you can't go to the other extreme and say that you shouldn't practice Krishna consciousness. But we have to remember this. So the demons actually, in a sense, are Mimamsas, because they think that, you know, like the dark side of the force. They think that there are laws in the universe. For example, one prominent law which Hiranyakashipu really locked into was the tapasya equals shakti equation. That if you perform austerities, you'll get power. And the demons love this one because they love power. And so demons often perform these sort of like horrible austerities. Hiranyakashipu is like, I mean, you can't get more austere than that. He he was so austere, he fasted. You want to talk about a fast, like an internal cleansing? Hiranyakashipu fasted till there was no flesh left in his body. He was just a skeleton, and yet he was so powerful he kept his prana, his life air, moving around in his bones. So, you know, like they say, don't try that at home. You could hurt yourself. So the asuras, they try to mechanize success. And that's what everybody does. Like, you know, like there's all these books about how to get rich quick. Actually, the way to really get rich quick is to write a book on how to get rich quick. So, tasya daitya putek putras chatwara paramadbhuta prahadu bhun mahans teshan gunayar maharupasaka. I also wanted to say a few words about this word, two other points here. Upasaka. There are various forms of this word, like upasana and so on. Upa. Upa in Sanskrit means near. We still have the word upa in English, by the way. Upa comes to us through Greek. In Greek, ancient Greek, they don't pronounce an H at the beginning of the word like in English honor or hour. Like what? How many hours does it take? Hour, honor. So the Y in Greek is pronounced like an umlaut. Anyway, a U, like a French or German U. So the word hypo, like hypochondriac, hypothermia, is just in Greek would have been pronounced upo. So actually hypo, which means less than, like hypothermia, less than enough heat. And that's what upa is, like an upa purana, a junior purana, an upa veda. Or, for example, you take a person's name like Indra, and then the younger brother, you put upa before, like Indra and junior Indra. So you get upendra, and so on. So upa means near. In other words, not quite there, but near. It also means subordinate, because it's in the sense of being near but not quite at the point, so it's subordinate and close. And so as, of course, in Sanskrit just means to sit. Like that's where you get the word asana, or the, you know, as we say, asana, vyasasan. Anyway, so upa asana or upa as means to sit near, but as also means in Sanskrit not only to sit, but it's used almost as like it means to continue doing something. Or to remain in, like almost like an auxiliary verb. Like in English, you would say to continue doing that, or to keep on standing there. And so they also use that verb. So upa as means to continually stay near someone in the sense of serving, attending on that person, and so on. So that's why upasaka, like upasana, means worship in the sense of like deity worship, personally attending the deity, staying near the deity and doing everything the deity requires. So ka is, we have the word upasaka. Ka is an abbreviation of Sanskrit kara, doing. So it's literally doing upasa, like always staying near, always attending on. So upasaka. Here it said that Prahlad was mahad upasaka. He was always serving, staying, literally staying near, attending the great, of course, either great souls, Vaishnavas or Krishna. And therefore, he was great. So whatever we choose to serve, what did Bob Dylan say? Bob Dylan, by the way, once drove all the way from New York to Los Angeles, chanting Hare Krishna. You know that story? There was a brahmachari named Pavana. I knew him from Boston when we were together in New Orleans. And he left ashram life, as we now say it, and he somehow he ran into Bob Dylan, who was driving a new van from L.A. to New York, New York to L.A., so he drove with him. He had a driver, and the whole way they chanted Hare Krishna. And then Bob Dylan came out with the song, You Got to Serve Someone. He probably got that on the trip. So, I don't know. It's another story. So, you've got to serve someone. Even if we try to serve ourselves, the funny thing is that if we try to serve ourselves, we can't. It's like there are certain things you just can't do, like moving your hands in certain ways. So, because when you try to serve yourself, you actually become existentially dislocated.
you know, like you can dislocate one of your bones or muscles or something. Because what we are, just who we are, the way we exist is that we are ourselves. We become ourselves, so to speak, in the act of serving Krishna. It's in the act of serving Krishna that we are doing what we do. It's just like Aristotle in his Nicomachean Ethics. He wrote a book on, anyway, Arete. So, Aristotle and Plato and other philosophers back then were trying to say, what is virtue? What does it mean to be good? What is goodness? And so Aristotle said, to be good means to do whatever you're made to do well. Like if you say, this is a good knife, it means it cuts well. If you say, this is a good helicopter, or this is a good person. So then you have to ask the question, what are people meant to do? Just as, this is teleological, just as a knife is made to cut, what are people made to do? What is our objective purpose in life? And of course, our purpose is to engage in pure, unlimited loving relationships with Krishna and other souls. And so it's in the act of doing that that we actually become ourselves. Therefore, you have this term in the Gita, Atmavan, just like Bhagavan, one who possesses Bhaga opulence. So Atmavan means you possess yourself, because you can lose yourself. I mean, Krishna uses in the Gita the term Atmavan, possessing yourself, and the term nashtatma, losing yourself. Like you can forget where you put yourself. Sort of like, you know, like car keys or something. So the idea here is that if I try to serve myself, like I'm just going to gratify myself, in the act of doing that, I am betraying myself, and I can't really serve myself because I'm taking the body as a self. I'm trying to serve the bodily self, which is actually a misunderstanding. It's simply an illusion. The body really exists. I really exist. The body really is valuable if used properly. But when I try to use it as the center of my enjoyment, that's not what it is. It's like trying to use a pomegranate, I don't know, to solder two wires or something. That's just, pomegranates don't solder. So, you know, helicopters don't sing. So the body is just not the center of enjoyment. And so it's actually impossible to, in a self-centered way, to truly serve yourself. You can only betray yourself in the false attempt to serve yourself. And so it's like that famous example from the Bhagavatam, jitha taror mula nishechanena, just like by watering the root of a tree. So, or giving food to the stomach, you feed the whole body, water the whole tree. So you can like get a high pressure hose and say, man, I'm going to force that tree to take this water. And you can, you know, just blow the tree down with a high pressure fire hose or something, but you're not going to water the tree. Trees, just, they're not made that way. Trees are so made, they don't drink through their branches. In fact, in Sanskrit, one name for tree is padapa, foot drinker. So that's just the way trees are. They drink to their roots. So similarly, there is a root to our existence. Our existence has a root, and that root is Krishna. So it's in the act of pleasing Krishna that we actually serve ourselves. So this is, therefore, Prahlad says in his prayers, Natevidu Sartha Gatinghi Vishnu. People don't know the real way to serve your self-interest. The real way to serve your self-interest is by taking Krishna seriously. Because we're part of Krishna. We're part of Krishna. So forgetting Krishna is the original shoot yourself in the foot strategy. Because when I turn away from Krishna, Ishada Peta, when I turn away from Krishna, I'm turning away from myself. Because I'm part of Krishna. We're in this together. So I can only love myself as much as I love Krishna. So the idea of self-esteem without Krishna's esteem is mere vanity. It's just madness. It's like saying, yes,
I have very healthy self-esteem because I'm actually very proud to be Julius Caesar. Hello. So, right? You just got a scholarship at a funny farm if you told it. So, the point is saying, yeah, I have a lot of self-esteem because I'm Julius Caesar and I conquered Gaul and I created the Julian calendar we now use. That's why July is named July after Julius Caesar. But the real fact is I'm not, at least in this life, I'm not Julius Caesar. And therefore being proud or having self-esteem because I think I'm Julius Caesar is just madness. And so having self-esteem because my body is beautiful, it's like, excuse me, but you're not the body. You're like way off target. Real self-esteem must include Krishna esteem. Because I'm part of Krishna. And if it includes Krishna esteem, it's like God isn't the co-pilot. Actually, I'm the co-pilot. Or maybe a flight attendant. So it's this understanding that in order to be happy, I have to make Krishna happy. If you're ever unhappy, if you're ever depressed or morose or down in the dumps, or boy, I'm starting to sound like some 60s songs, right? So if you're ever unhappy, whenever you're unhappy, the worst thing you can do is try to make yourself happy, because you'll just make yourself unhappier. If you're ever unhappy, just call time out in the field, time out in the kshetra, and just realize, I must not be making Krishna happy right now. At this moment, I must not be pleasing Krishna. Don't get faked out by Maya. I grew up in L.A., actually, and we had this famous basketball announcer for the Lakers, Chick Hearn, and one of his, what we call it, signature expressions was, he'd say, faked him into the popcorn machine. Like someone did a fake. He's like faked it out the other person. Say faked him. Because there's like in those days in the basketball court, they'd have these little popcorn wagons that would go by. Faked him into the popcorn machine. So don't get faked out by Maya. If you're unhappy, please Krishna. Just stop what you're doing. Just stop what you're doing and think, right now at this very second, how can I please Krishna? Whether it's just crying out his name, doing something Krishna conscious for some other person. As soon as you please Krishna, you will be happy because you're watering the root of the tree. And Maya tells us, you're unhappy, try to be happy. My mother, you told me, I remember when I was a kid, she told me a story. She grew up actually on a ranch in Riverside, California. And she was a little naive. She got married. And so when she had her first kid, my older brother, one day he had a fever, so she was kind of like all, you know, panicking because her first child had a fever. So because he had a fever, she thought she'd take him outside to cool him off. She's actually a very intelligent lady, but she, at that point in her life, still was a little naive. So, I mean, so some so-called obvious solutions are not really the solution. You don't cool somebody off with a fever by taking them into an ice box. And similarly, if you're unhappy, you don't become happy by... The reason we're unhappy is because we forgot Krishna and tried to enjoy without Krishna. That's the cause of our unhappiness. So trying to make yourself happy is just making the problem worse. And if we try to please Krishna, we'll actually be happy. So here it said about Prahlad Maharaj, he served, attended on, stayed near the great souls. To stay near Krishna, you have to really give up. We have to give up our false ego. Because just like we don't like to be around people that are like, oh, let's say this person is too successful. I like to be around people that don't intimidate me, or I don't want to feel that I'm less than this person. So I'd rather be with people who, you know. So the false ego means I don't want to be around Krishna. Precisely because he is the greatest person, I don't want to be around him all the time. Because it doesn't leave space for self-centeredness. Precisely because Krishna has all these opulences, I need some downtime, literally. I need some downtime away from Krishna. So you've got to overcome this false ego and realize that we're part of Krishna. A rising tide lifts all boats. And so the more we glorify Krishna, the more we love Krishna, the more we're loving ourselves, the more we're serving ourselves, the more we'll have the life we really want, like Prahlad. So thank you very much. Any questions on these points? Yes, Badri.
talk show for him.
Hare Krishna. I was just curious. You were saying that, you know, we can't judge by the externals, that someone may be rising early in the morning because they don't want to lose their free rent. Who knows what the motivation is, right? At the same time, suppose I'm not getting up for Mangal Aarti. Suppose I'm sleeping in the ashram. Suppose I'm, you know, whatever, dodging whatever I'm supposed to do. And I say, well, you don't know what's in my heart. You know, me and Krishna, we're tight. Bhava Grihi Janardhanam. So don't judge me by the externals. You don't know what's in my heart. How would you respond to that?
I would say, first of all, I mean, it's a good point because I didn't want to...
Not that you... Picking a point.
I would say, first of all, a devotee, let's say, who was not able to really practice sadhana bhakti in a thrilling way, but was sincere, will be the last person in the world to boast about their devotion. The sign of someone that whose heart was really in the right place is that they would feel bad about it, and they would actually lament. So that combination of not practicing and having a lot of pride. Yeah. Anything else? Yes. Bhriguji, the Muni.
Why does Krishna expand as the living entities?
Why does he expand as a living entity? Entities. It's interesting. For example, Krishna says in the Gita, Ahang Sarvasya Prabhava, I'm the source of everything. Matak Sarvam Pravartate, everything emanates from me or proceeds from me. So we use verbs like that, emanate, proceed, or create. Actually, the reality that Krishna describes throughout the Gita is that Natevaham Jatu Nasam, we have always existed. And Krishna's always existed. So we are Krishna's internal energy, or superior energy. So Krishna was never, because Krishna has always existed, his energy has always existed. Because Krishna never existed without his energy. So we have always existed. So Krishna chooses, again, when we say Krishna chooses, it doesn't mean that like we do, like, you know, one fine day I made a choice. And so there's a pre-choice time and a post-choice time. But rather here we're talking about an eternal state of affairs, where eternally Krishna is expanded into the living beings. And Krishna... You know, hey Krishna, Karuna Sindhu is an ocean of mercy, an ocean of love. And so Prabhupada said one time, we are not impersonalists. We don't see Krishna alone. So existing in sort of solitary glory is, I mean, it's the very nature of Krishna. It's one of the central features of his perfect nature, of his infinite perfection, is that he is infinitely generous and infinitely loving, and there are infinite living beings who share in the glory of God and share in all of Krishna's happiness. So it is a central part of his supreme perfection.
Thank you, Maharaj, for an enlightening class. You had mentioned how the danger of practicing devotional service in a mechanized way will not give us the result that we're looking for. And I'm wondering if you could just touch upon a little bit how we could become more aware of if we are actually following in such a way, and how we could... rectify that situation.
First of all, what occurs to me is that famous verse in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam that predicts Lord Chaitanya's movement, yagyara sankirtana prayar yajantihi sumedasa.
people of, with good intelligence worship the Lord in this age. And so the power of introspection, the power to be honest with yourself, to look at yourself and say, what am I really doing here? What is my real intention? Is a necessary qualification. It's certainly not academic. It's not an intellectual process. It's just being honest enough and courageous enough to take a good, hard look at what am I really doing? What are my real motives? So that's one thing. And another type of intelligence needed to successfully perform the Yuga Dharma is that, as I always say, the right answer to the wrong question is the wrong answer. So, for example, if you ask the question, how can I be happy? I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, the great framing question, how can I be happy by surrendering to Krishna? But once you've understood that real happiness means surrendering to Krishna, then the question is not where can I be happy, but how can I really please Prabhupada? And of course, it has to be balanced, because Krishna says in the Gita again and again that even a wise person follows their nature. So when you ask the question, how can I best please Prabhupada, how can I best please Krishna, the question is asked within the context of what's really possible for me. And Krishna tells Arjuna that ultimately acting outside of your nature, against your nature, is not sustainable. Janechasi mohat karishasi yavashopita. The very thing that out of illusion you don't want to do, you will do against your wish. Avasha. That's one of Monier Williams' definitions, against your wish. So again, if I could say, well, probably really pleased if under my own strength, without any mechanical device, I just levitated and flew up into the sky and manifested the most amazing holograms and laser, you know, light shows ever seen on Earth, and performed other miracles, healed the sick, made Amtrak run on time. But that's just not within the realm of possibility. It's just not something I don't want to talk about my powers. it's just not something. It's not something we can do. But again, the right question is, how can I best serve Krishna? It's not about where can I be most comfortable. It's not being an ease lover, as you know, a term Prabhupada used. Where can I best serve? How can I best serve? What's the best thing I can do for Prabhupada? And within real options, within the options that are actually sustainable according to Krishna's criteria in the Gita. So Krishna says to Arjuna, Nibaddhak Swena Karmana. What is that? Subhava jena kunteya, nivaddhak swena karmana. You are bound, nivaddha, you are bound by the duty which is born of your nature. Sadrasham cheshtate swasya prakritir jnanavanapi. You know the word jnanavan, one who has knowledge. What is that, 719, bahunam jnanam. So jnanavan is a big term in the Gita, one who has knowledge, one who really got it. And that even the Jnanavan will act according to their own nature. So the idea that when you become enlightened, when you become Krishna conscious, when you surrender, you become denatured and you have no nature is not our philosophy. In fact, even the Yusupanishad says, vidyang cha jastad vedo bhayang saha. Avidyaya mrityung tirtva. You cross over death by really understanding the lower nature, your human side, or what this world is. And then vidyayamrita mashnute. And by spiritual knowledge, you enjoy immortality. So it's interesting. If you look at those two, by avidya, meaning, of course, knowledge of this world, you cross over death. So there's a negative and a positive. You have to get past something, and you have to achieve something. And so the Upanishad says to get past mrityu, to get past this world, you know, what Krishna describes as mrityu sangsara vartma, the path of repeated death. That's what he calls it. In order to get past this,
You have to understand it. You actually have to understand what this world, what your human nature is, and so on and so forth. And so again, within our real possibilities, according to the Gita, within our nature, what's the best thing I could do for Prabhupada? How could I best serve? How could I best serve Krishna? And when you follow that path, it's like if you're on the highway, you're trying to get somewhere, and there's a little side path, looks like it goes through a really beautiful forest, there's a lake out there or something, but you're late for a program. In other words, are we taking detours, or are we really staying on the road? Are we really, as Prabhupada said, like a military discipline? Are we disciplined and really focused on trying to serve? So, and serving in ISKCON, that's one point I was talking about yesterday in our committee meeting, that I find for myself, for example, in ISKCON, I perform services like that of Guru or Sannyasi, et cetera, which is it's a great way to, probably the only way left in this world to really get a free lunch. But having all these things that Prabhupada called these super titles, he called it the super title of Goswami. And so we should not be naive. We should not, let's say someone who's acting in a big position should not foolishly think that Maya cannot touch me, that all this honor and prestige and blah, 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 that this could never affect me, this never goes to my head, I never become proud. In fact, as soon as someone really begins to think, who am I? I'm a guru. You're kind of like illusory toast. Because actually, we are tiny souls. We are tiny, insignificant souls, somehow or other, being engaged in a particular service. And so Prabhupada asked us to work in ISKCON. And working in ISKCON, which means give and take, and that can be very annoying. In other words, I want to do things my way. I'm surrounded by people that have to honor me and bow down to me. And so it can be annoying to have to deal with other people that don't just do that. Because actually, I like it better when people just bow down and obey. You're not doing that. I don't think I like that as much. So the idea is that living in a society where I am relativized because there are many other gurus and there are many other preachers and many other great souls, men and women. And so being in a society that relativizes me and I can't always have my way or say like, you know, okay, I'm going to take my preaching ball and go home or something, as we've seen some people do in the name of higher realizations. So it's actually good for my self-realization. I think it's actually a check and balance. I think it actually keeps my spiritual life healthy, the fact that I am in a situation where sometimes I am, you know, God on earth, and sometimes you jerk. What are you doing? So, I mean, we all need to, you know, be a little humble sometimes. So it's all part of self-realization. Yes, one more question, will you? I don't want to commit the mad elephant offense of delaying your breakfast.
Maharaj, some people say that it's not my nature to follow the four regulative principles, or it's not my nature to chant. I can't do it.
Okay. That's not exactly what Krishna means by nature, at least in that context. By nature, he means sort of your varna nature, your vocational nature. And of course, we could also say by extension, your ashram nature. If someone says that, still, someone says, I just can't do it. It's just over my head. I just can't do it. That can be an act of existential honesty and humility. Or it can simply be an act of self-indulgence. It depends on what the motive is. If you say at this point, I can't follow the principles in Sand 16 Rounds, however, I see the extraordinary value of doing that, and I honor people who do that, and I will try to serve those who are doing it, and I will try to patiently chant Hare Krishna so that someday I can do it. So if you say it's not my, you know, I'm not able to follow these principles, period, and that's all you have to say for yourself, then it's not impressive. Because some people are able to do it, so why not serve those people and get their mercy?
Why not aspire to do it patiently, but aspire? Yes.
Talking about one's nature, if one's nature is to be a certain way and it doesn't seem comfortable to be in a community because you're not able to express your nature, but also that community can also be such an avenue for one's personal self-expression. And if taken in a Krishna conscious point of view, it can be a real golden opportunity for self-expression and creativity in Krishna's service, under the direction of authority and under the direction of the spiritual master. So it seems to me that Prabhupada created communities for that kind of direction to be cultivated in a real substantial way, because it can get so kind of very loose in other situations.
I hope I didn't give the wrong impression. So let me emphasize that we all need community. It's actually something which is essential for our spiritual life. And Prabhupada said, and there are many, many benefits. Prabhupada said that if you try to be Krishna conscious alone, it will not be successful. So, yes, I didn't want to give the impression that we shouldn't live in communities. It's something we all need, and something from which we all receive an essential benefit. And not only for gurus, but for everyone. Bottle washers. Do we have bottle washers? Do we wash bottles? We have pot washers. I guess we don't have bottle washers. We don't wash bottles. It's not Vedic culture. So, yes, for all of us, living in a community is a purifying experience. Yes, and there are innumerable daily benefits. We just have to take it in the right spirit. Thank you. So we'll stop. Kavichandra Swami. There's a great soul.
Very nice class, so thank you very much. One of the big Christian preachers, he says you have to live in the church, you have to work in the community, otherwise it's impossible to develop tolerance. You know, by yourself, you're never going to be patient and tolerant, just puffed up, you know. But within the society, we have to be, you know, it's the only way to develop those essential qualities, like you were saying. So I just thought,
yeah, I know myself. I live in a situation where there's not so many devotees around. I mean, some, but not so many. And so coming into work is actually thrilling. I mean, to see all the devotees. And the deities, I went and sat in Prabhupada's garden this morning, and of course I spent so much time with Prabhupada there, of course, next to the garden is the kitchen that produces all kinds of, you know, wonderful transcendental sounds, like, you know, grinding and banging. But as I was sitting there in the garden, I was just thinking that when I come and see the deities here, it is such an enlightening, ecstatic experience, and yet there are people working day in and day out, you know, hour after hour, so that I can come and see the deities. Because the reason the deities are so ecstatic is because they're being served so nicely. And so I was thinking that's because of these people, these devotees that are, you know, banging away there in the kitchen, that they're really supporting and making possible my experience of Krishna. And so that's, I think, the spirit of community. Like Prabhupada said, the different parts of the body. But they're all necessary. So, thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.